welcome to the Faithless Brewing Podcast. I'm your host, Dan Schriever, also known as Cave Dan, coming to you from deep in the heart of Texas. And I am joined today by the one and only, the man, the symbol, the mana symbol. You know him as Zach Ryle. Zach, welcome back, my friend.
Hey, buddy. How you doing? It's a beautiful day here in Miami. We've got some kind of ultra music festival that's bringing 1 million, I assume, EDM concert goers to the great city of Miami. But I'm not getting involved in any of that. No, I'm sitting here in a dimly lit piano bar with a laptop in front of me, and I'm ready to talk some magic.
Oh, boy. Okay, yeah. I mean, I have questions for you. We can talk magic for sure, but first of all, where in the world are you? So, Miami.
Yeah.
You're just in port right now. Is that right.
My
understanding?
We are docked in what I have been told is the world's busiest cruise port, officially. And I'm hoping to see it featured in the upcoming Grand Theft Auto 6, because they're returning to Vice City, which is, of course, based off of Miami. And now that I've been here a bunch, I just think it would be really sweet if at some point you got to go up onto a cruise ship and be running around shooting guns. Not that I'm ever tempted to do that, but, you know.
Oh, my gosh. Okay. So catch us up a little bit. You mentioned you're in a piano bar. What have you been up to for the past 6-7 months?
Well, at the moment, I'm just finishing up this contract with a wonderful rock band on the ship. There's 6 people in the band, a male singer, female singer, drums, bass, keyboards, and guitar. My good friend, Tag Ryan, who I went to Nebraska to help record his album of original music last summer. He's the guitar player. And then we're just wrapping up that kind of 7-month run, doing a lot of music. And then I'm actually signed up for my next contract, which is going to be on one of the new purchases from Carnival. They bought some ships from a different cruise line, which I think is actually owned by Carnival Corporation. So it's a whole Ouroboros confusing corporate nonsense thing. But I'm pretty sure I'm going to be going to the Carnival Firenze, which is going to be in Long Beach. So that's going to be about 4 months from now. So we don't have to talk about that yet. What we do definitely need to talk about is some magic news, some magic decks, because boy, do we have a real corker of an episode here based on some of the decks that you and David worked on, and that some of which I played, some of which you played, some of which he played, to varying levels of, let's say, extreme results.
It's going to be an extreme episode today. That's a great word for it. Yeah, we played a lot of magic this week. We got some 5-0s. We got multiple 5-0s. We got some 05s, multiple 05s, and everything in between. We got magic news, we got brews, we got a flashback looking at a few different concepts we've been talking about in previous episodes. Zach and I got a chance to try those out, and of course David is always hard at work brewing up the new spice. So yeah, plenty to dive into. Before we jump into the content, we got to give a quick shout out to our Patreon and welcome our newest patrons. And there are a lot of them this week. So big Faithless Brewing welcome to Daniel C, Brett B, Gavin, Skip Billy, and Dave M, who's increased his pledge. Thank you very, very much to all of those individuals for your support, and welcome to the Faithless family. Just a reminder that if you're enjoying the program and would like to help keep the lights on here, you can head over to patreon.com/faithlessbrewing. That's where you can sign up, make a pledge at any tier you like, and gets you access to our wonderful Discord community.
Yes, it's viewer-supported public podcasting. Eventually, I hope that someday we'll have tote bags. So, with all of that out of the way, is there any of this news of the week that you think is super worth talking about? Because looking at everything that has happened in the world of Magic this week, it seems like a week of just waiting for things to happen. Of course, Outlaws of Thunder Junction is on the way, and we've got the teaser from Morrow. That's where he gives us a bunch of hints about cards that will be in the set. And it's kind of one of those things of it's so vague that it's almost it's almost meaningless.
Yeah, I liked the creature type list. I see there's armadillos are coming. Coyotes are coming, porcupines, mounts. So it's a Western theme set, so you can now mount up on a horse. Phantasmal mount from Ice Age is in shambles. Yeah, it should be fun. I mean, the flavor is one that's been like, people have been speculating on what would a Western theme set look like for decades now, right? I don't know why they didn't do it before.
I mean, I think at the time there was probably some hesitation about doing something that is so modern and real world, but they've found ways to do that with things that are like the Gothic horror, which obviously is actually even more modern than the Wild West times kind of deal. So it's like, oh, and we don't necessarily have to make any kind of, again, gun analog as part of this. So we do have some changes to organized play here. That's interesting. More RCQ slots. Canada going up to a robust 12.
Yeah. I mean, on the one hand, more slots is always good. I did not participate heavily yet in the RCQ system. I went to a few RCQs like last year. So I haven't felt the sting yet of getting to the regional championship, making it all the way to top eight, and then still not getting the slot. I know that Mord was telling us about how just absolutely brutal it is in South America, for example, where, you know, after all of that work, everyone from all the countries in South America qualifying for a regional championship, like in, you know, Chile or something, and there's only two slots for the Pro Tour after all that.
Right.
Well, he'll be happy to know that they've doubled their slots from two to four. So, the USA bias is very much a persistent theme of all of these changes, right? The USA gets double its slots, 64 qualifiers from the USA. The Pro Tours themselves are going to be held primarily in the United States. I think three of the four will be held in the US. The fourth one will be in Europe every year. And yeah, they're not really apologizing for that anymore. They're just saying this is where the player base is. This is where it makes sense for us financially to focus. I don't know how I feel about that.
I do think it's funny that Canada, with one-tenth the population of America, has one-quarter of the slots. I don't really think the math breaks down there. Not that I'm complaining about it.
Oh, so you think that Canada is actually benefiting from favoritism?
We seem to be. Yeah, I mean, if my math checks out.
Yeah, I mean, everything's supposed to be better in Canada. That's what I keep hearing. I felt like your East-West regional championship was also better. Face-to-face tour is better than anything we have here.
I will say, as someone who's worked on the face-to-face tour and who's attended many face-to-face events, I do love the way that they run their events. And it's just a wonderful, wonderful group of people who both run the events and especially the judge staff. They're great, great folks. But a lot of them cross the border for American events as well. So got a very porous relationship with that American border and that magic communities.
They're coming for our RC slots. Build the wall.
Yeah, yes, you got to watch out, buddy. And you've got something here about a new content creator program for Magic Online?
Yeah, just a little tidbit of news. I haven't really announced any details yet. So all we know is that there is something called the Magic Online Creator Program in the works. So they say it's coming soon. It's implied that if you're registered as a Magic Online content creator of some kind, you'll get some sort of monthly perks. Who knows what that is? Like, maybe it's play points. It's probably just like an avatar. And then exclusive access to an upcoming event. Who knows what that means? It's something at least. They're at least acknowledging that Magic Online exists. And I should clarify, this is entirely a Daybreak Games initiative. This is, I think, Wizards of the Coast has very little to do with this. I think they've just told Daybreak, you know, here's how much money you can spend on, you know, supporting the player base, supporting Premier Play. And Daybreak has reallocated some of the money that used to go towards prize money for the showcases. And some of that is going to go towards, presumably, this content creator program. So we'll see what that means. You know, we're a Magic Online podcast. We only play these tabletop / Magic Online ancient formats. So it's just kind of strange. It feels strange to be remembered.
Yeah, it really does. It is one of those things that sounds great, but I feel like we've been let down a lot of times before. So we'll let time tell how much we'll actually should be excited about that.
I mean, I think I'll look into it at least.
Oh, absolutely. We're going to look into it. Oh, absolutely. We're going to look into it. But with, I would say, to borrow a word from David, some couched feelings about it. We're going to reserved excitement.
I mean, if nothing else, at least to just let them know that there are people out there interested in Magic Online. That's the reason to support any of Daybreak Games' initiatives. Yeah,
absolutely. But I think they're aware of that. And actually, it was funny, as I was looking for Magic News today, I went to the Mothership website, the actual, you know, Hasbro Wizards website, magic.wizards.com. They have Magic Online listed in the Our Games section, and the list goes Arena, Tabletop, Magic Online, and then Competitive. So in terms of how they've set up their priorities, that's an interesting order for me to see. It's also really interesting to see the person playing Magic Online is doing it on what looks like a very souped-up gaming PC, which is not required.
That's pretty funny.
Yeah. Additionally, Arena lists that it's available on PC, Mac, Android, and iOS. Magic Online is, of course, only available on PC, as it should be.
All right. So, speaking of Magic Online, the showcase challenges happened over the weekend. These are some of the bigger events on Magic Online. You have some notes here, Zach. What did you see?
Oh, let's take a look at the we just had some interesting deck lists, and then of course some of the things that are just general trends in the formats. So in the modern format, we had Phil Hellmuth was the screen name, but I don't think that's the actual person. I'm pretty sure this is someone else. Correct me if I'm wrong, but taking down the showcase qualifier.
Not the poker star.
No, although there are a lot of poker players who play Magic, so maybe someone could correct me, because I have a feeling this is not actually that person, but there are a lot of Magic players who cross over to poker. But the point is, took down the event playing the one of the new hotnesses in modern, new in terms of how well it's been doing recently, the Goryeo's Vengeance attracts a Ephemerae kind of package deck.
Yeah, Phil Hellmuth is Sam Rolfe.
There you go. Thank you.
One of the new generation of pros. He's not new. He's old.
he's definitely like not pros. That. Yeah. And it's great to see that Indomitable Creativity was up there in second place. I know that deck has been struggling for some of the last year after its like super mega dominance a while back. So nice to see that it's able to compete on that level.
Are you liking what you see when you look at these modern lists? I mean, we just came off of banning, and somewhat even more surprisingly, this Leyline of the Guild Pact, Sign of Draco interaction is just turning out to be something you can shove into many different archetypes. So it's not just supporting Zoo, you can put it in almost anything. It's near the top of the metagame in different configurations.
It is. I don't know if the people in this tournament were particularly prepared for it, because in the top eight here, I'm only seeing one copy of that deck. It looks like two copies of Yawgmoth, one of Black Red Scam, one of Blue White quote unquote control. This is not actually like controlling build. This is like the kind of Narset, four subtlety, four solitude, four the One Ring. It's just like, I don't know, just throwing your hand at your opponent and then playing something that makes it all not matter. And some mono green Tron. So it looks very nicely diverse here. Actually, hold on. Are there two? There are two of these. I think there's two of these Zoo decks. No, just one. No, it looks nicely. The format looks diverse. And as I was looking through some of the other listed challenges, I was seeing, there's a lot of diversity in modern. So I feel like modern has gone through a lot of periods where people hate on it and then people embrace and love it. And as we're going into Modern Horizons 3, this looks pretty good. Now the only thing to do is see how ruined it gets.
Yeah. It's almost not even worth thinking about too much, because this will exist for, what, 2 months before it's all blown up?
Exactly.
But anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. So coming soon. Good to see again. Like Murktide is back. Like there's a lot of cool stuff happening, and someone played Scapeshift to a 20th place. Like that's the kind of thing I love to see.
We're not spending too much time on modern these days on the podcast, but Pioneer is, I think, the more interesting format.
Yes.
So we also have the Pioneer Showcase Challenge. What do we see there, Zach?
Well, it was won by the new sort of hotness, new top dog of the format for the moment, which is Black Red Vampires deck. Of course, it was played by Gracias Por Tanto, who is one of the top grinders in the Pioneer leagues. So I'm pretty sure this person would have done very, very well with whatever they decided to register. But they registered a version of this Black Red Vampires deck and took it all the way to the top there. So that's exciting to see, as well as there's some Boros Heroic here. We got some Blue-White Spirits. Let's see. We've got some Blue-White Control. We've got some Amalia Combo. And let's see what else here we got. The Mono Black Waste Knot deck.
I gotta ask you about that deck, Zach.
Yeah,
the Mono Black Waste Knot.
I'm looking at it right now.
Let's talk about Mono Black Waste Knot. I kept running into this deck. I think I played it like 3 or 4 times this week just in the leagues. I did not realize it was so popular, like, and it's actually pretty good.
Yeah, it seems to be.
You know, we consider Waste Knot like a card to just brew around and go nuts, but this is not really doing anything too fancy with Waste Knot. It's just like, I like Thoughtseize. Go Blank is solid enough, and with that in mind, like, that's enough. That's enough for me to just put Waste Knots in. Liliana the Veil, you would think, might be like a 4X, but sometimes they only play 2 copies. This person was playing 3. And then I guess the lock, the part where you really start to pull ahead, is in your mana base. Your mono black, so you have room for a ton of utility lands. And it's not just Hive of the Eye Tyrants and Castle Lochthwain's, but a large number of Field of Ruins. I've seen up to 5 in different configurations, although this list was only playing 2 Field of Ruins. They were going heavy on Gyre Reach Sanitarium, which we used to play with, like, the Narset lock, but it's also just a great card with Waste Knot. It's essentially, you know, you trigger Waste Knot just for the low, low price of an activation. And if you have 2 Waste Knots, you know, the longer the game goes as you grind everyone's resources down, the more inevitable your Waste Knot endgame becomes.
Yeah, it is kind of neat. And I played against this at least once myself. I want to say I lost to it. I can't remember which deck I was playing at the time, because in the last couple of weeks, I've suddenly picked up a bunch of Magic. Who knew? Yeah, it definitely is surprisingly good. It definitely gets to ride a little bit on the fact that playing Shieldred is just like a bunch of free wins. But interestingly, it's not really playing a lot of other creatures to tax people's removal, but they are playing 2 Duress, in this case, 2 Duress, 4 Thoughtseize, 4 Go Blanks. I think, yeah, you end up putting a lot of different types of pressure on your opponent with this deck. You're attacking with your lands. You're attacking with a type of permanent that's not easy to interact with, an enchantment. You've got sweepers. You've got spot removal. And you've got filtering. The Gyre Reach Sanitarium even helps you with the fact that, you know, you're playing 4 Fatal Push. And if you're not playing a Fatal Push matchup, like, what are you going to do? Well, actually, you're just going to hang out against Blue-White Control and just filter that into cards that matter.
Oh, so you think the Gyre Reach actually allows it to win game 1 against Control?
I mean, allows it or assists it. I'm not going to say one way or the other, but it certainly looks like it would, right?
I can see that. It's got a huge amount of targeted discard, not just 4 Thoughtseize, but also 2 Duress. And on top of that, you have Go Blanks and Liliana's pressuring the hands. So if one of the paths to victory is to just solo them with a Shieldred unanswered, it's like almost impossible to hold removal for Shieldred against this deck.
Yeah.
You'll be holding your removal because they have no threats, but eventually you got to chuck those cards. Like, you can't just hold on to them forever. They're going to get gobbled up. And then eventually, if they top deck a Shieldred, you know, you don't have that long to kill them before Shieldred comes down and just solos you. So yeah, it's a surprisingly robust, resilient deck. I've had decent success defeating it this week, but that's mainly because, you know, David's list that he was telling me to try were really heavy on utility lands, and I found that I was winning when I was able to have more utility lands than them. Like if I had a Hall of Storm Giants that could get a couple hits in, or if I have Murex going the distance. But I mean, they're accounting for that. They have Field of Ruins. So it was really like, there was no clear angle to beat this deck.
Yeah, absolutely.
I was surprised how many bases it has covered. In the winning list, Zach, so you mentioned it was a new version of Vampires. I noticed they're playing not just the four Vein Rippers, but they're going heavy on Flyers. They're also playing three Archfiend of the Dross. Archfiend here without the Metamorphic Alteration combo, right? Just as a gigantic closer.
Yeah, and it can't be dropped in off of Sorin, which is one of those, because it's a Phyrexian demon, not a vampire. So they're actually planning on casting that, which obviously the gap between three and four is not that big, but it is surprising to see it a little bit.
It's a very fair Archfiend. This is something that, you know, La Levin, friend of the show, has written about in the past on his blog, whatifbrews.com. Just the closing speed of Archfiend is something that it's really hard to replicate in Pioneer. In fact, one of the things that Law 11 found so powerful about Archfiend was that the ability to close the game quickly is something that like only a Shale Dread could do. And then that insight is, I think, what led the Channel Fireball Ultimate Guard team to lean on Vein Ripper as well. If you concluded that you like that angle, the ability to just close things out immediately with a large flyer, yeah, why limit yourself to just four? You get the four Vein Rippers and the three Archfiends. I don't know if that's actually the thought process or if it's just, you know, it happens to line up well against the expected metagame.
Yeah. I mean, it could be that. And it's interesting to see that because the expected metagame, we're not seeing as much of it in the top eight as you'd expect. Zero copies of Phoenix made it into this particular top eight. And if you browse down to the top 16, you'll see a few copies that got obviously squeezed out of contention, as well as many more copies of Amalia combo. So it seems like the people who came in with the decks that made it into the top eight were like hard targeting the metagame.
Yeah, so speaking of the metagame, David is our Pioneer expert these days. He's not with us this week, but he's left us his thoughts on the format as it currently stands. His read on it is that essentially Pioneer is about as unfair as it's ever been. There's a very high density of combo decks in the format. Not as much as, say, like the combo summer that led to the massive bannings, but combo in the sense that even the fair decks that are trying to kill you with damage are trying to do something fundamentally unfair. So if you think about the aggro decks, those are Boros Convoke, Boros Heroic. There's essentially creature combo decks, right, where you could just have an unbeatable sequence of cards that synergize with each other in your opening 10 cards. Goldfish Keel will probably happen on turn four. It's almost like a pseudo combo, if that's fair to say.
It absolutely is. As someone who's played against this Boros Heroic deck a couple times in the last week, it's brutal.
Yeah. Now you take the same logic and you think, okay, well, what about the mid-range list? It used to be that mid-range was red-black mid-range. Well, now it's red-black vampires. Mid-range here, we're talking about decks that have removal and creatures. So the Vampires list is trying to do that unfair thing that just ends the game very, very quickly with the Vein Ripper or potentially also with Archfiend. Phoenix is mid-range, right? Card draw, removal, creatures, but the creatures have recursion, right? So they're unfair creatures. You're not going to beat them with just regular old Magic, solid curve, good threats, and, you know, efficient removal. That's just not going to get you anywhere against the current breed of mid-range or the current breed of aggro. If you think about what are the value lists, I guess the value deck right now would be, you know, the Collected Company Amalia combo. And they're not even maxing out Collected Company. They're preferring tutors. They're maxing out on Court of Callings and Return to the Ranks because the primary plan is to assemble the game winning combo. And like the individual cards in that deck are just garbage, but the combo itself is so strong that, you know, you can just win that way through removal. Removal is actually like not that effective against the Amalia combo either.
Yeah, I mean, as a creature combo deck, that's just what they're expecting on every axis. So it's kind of what they built themselves to be.
Yeah, exactly. Then you get like proper combo with the Lotus Field, which got upgraded with Archdruid's Charm. And then on the control side, I mean, nothing new happening in control. They're just getting very, very good, very sleek, very efficient. Removal has gotten much better. Get Lost has turned out to be a huge player. That was a list that I 5-0'd with, and I was super impressed with Get Lost. Blue White gets the new Mana Leak upgrade, No More Lies, and Blue Black gets Deduce, which triggers Revolt for Fatal Push. So everything has just gotten stronger now. If you look at this metagame and you think, where is there room to brew? Where is there room to like sneak in a slick brew and get that 5-0? It's not totally clear where the cracks are in this metagame, Zach.
I can completely agree with that. I find Get Lost incredibly obnoxious as a card. It's just one of those things that I was happy for a long time that didn't exist in Pioneer, that there wasn't anything like that. There was the one that made a clue, which was a little bit more palatable and didn't see as much play. But Get Lost is really brutal out of any deck that's playing white, just giving you two maps, which are, I don't know, they feel useless a lot of the time. So they're essentially, they just have like a 2-mana Vindicate for your creature or planeswalker.
Yeah, it gets enchantments too.
Oh, yeah.
So it's at least some counterplay against Waste Not.
Oh, thank God. It
can take out a temporary lockdown, takes out a Leyland Binding.
Yeah,
that card is way stronger than I gave it credit for.
Yeah.
All right, so basically you shouldn't be trying to do something fair in Pioneer. Which brings us now to the flashback segment.
With all the incredibly fair decks we were playing.
We're doing our best.
Oh, boy.
How about some fair teamer midrange?
Yeah.
Let's get into the team. Let's get to the Kefnet content. This is what people are here. They've endured several minutes of non-Kefnet content. Let's get into the Kefnet list, Zach.
Yeah.
So we've been playing some speculative stuff. Why don't we start with you? Where did you start in your testing, and what were your impressions?
Yeah, so I started with, I think it was Dan's Kefnet Galzeth combo deck, which I will add the screenshot. I have a screenshot of that deck list. I can't add it right now. The version 2 is a little bit further down the page, but I do have the, I did play the version 1. So it was playing 4 copies of Growth Spiral, 4 copies of Kellen Inquisitive Prodigy. So 8 kind of Growth Spiral effects with 27 lands, including the modal double face card, Balaged Recovery. And the idea was that you could kind of jump off the curve to 4 drops, such as 3 God Eternal Kefnets, 2 Galazeth Prismaris, 3 ill-timed explosions as your sweeper. And of course, you can cast the backside of Kellen. And the rest of the deck was filled out with spells, Torch the Tower, Deduce, Divide by 0, because in theory, Galazeth and all of these Growth Spiral effects allowed you to ramp All Runs Epiphany as theoretically an end game that you can either cast off of all the mana from the treasures, or if you flip it up on God Eternal Kefnet, that's going to be a huge blowout, assuming you have the required 5 mana to cast the copy. So I head into the leagues with this deck, feeling pretty good about myself. Deduce, of course, was the card of the week, and that combos with God Eternal Kefnet in that it allows you to draw on your opponent's turn twice for 2 mana each time, both of the actual spell and the clue, and then the clue itself can tap for mana if you have a Galazeth. So the first deck I ran into, surprisingly, was Greasefang. And I had high hopes because I took down Greasefang pretty convincingly in game 1. Torched the Tower with a clue sitting around, had my opponent's rats pinned. And then in game 2, they mulled to 5, and they just kind of weren't able to do much, and I was able to take that one. Then things started going, let's say how they were supposed to, it feels like. Because I then ran into matches against Jeskai Ascendancy, a black-green sacrifice deck, Amalia combo, and mono red aggro. And I felt like I was really outgunned in almost every single one of these matchups, which is kind of funny considering that I actually did have good tools for some of them. Like against black green sacrifice, we had ill timed explosions, which should have been super, super helpful. So, I mean, in the first through, one of the things that was the biggest thing for me, and maybe I just don't have the heart for this, but I did try again. The thing that stuck out for me was God Eternal Kefnet, Galazeth, and Kellen. all of these four drops just didn't feel like they were on the power level of the format, or I don't know if the right word is power level, or this is just not what the format was about. Kellen being the replicative effect for Growth Spiral is kind of neat, but then you need another four drop in play to be maximizing on those things. So that's tricky. Galzeth was the one of the four drops we were playing the least number of, and sometimes seemed to be the most powerful because giving you this like kind of big mana engine. Like sometimes you had two clues and then Galzeth brings a treasure and all of a sudden you have three extra mana to start kind of chaining spells off. But Galzeth itself doesn't actually generate any value in any way.
Well, you get a treasure. That's something. You can turn that treasure into a card with Kellen.
You can. If you've actually cast one four drop and then the next four drop and then you're attacking with your Kellen. So I thought that this was kind of promising and maybe there was just some bad breaks. And so what I did is I took the shell that David had created here, this kind of teamer control mid-range shell, and I decided to port that into a deck that I really enjoyed before, which is the Chandra Turns deck. Because we were already playing the Alrun's Epiphanies here, so I thought, what if we played Chandra Beacon of Hope along with Growth Spiral, Deduce, and the Kellens? With the idea being that this mana engine would replace what in the other deck was like Fable of the Mirror Breaker and Big Score that helped you get up to the Chandra. And then at the time, Chandra was, when it resolved, I pretty much never lost a game. This league also did not go particularly well. This was a pretty brutal 0-4, although I will say that I played against Phoenix three times, and that's just a terrible matchup. And the I also played against Blue-Black Vampires with mutagenic, or what is it, Metamorphic Alteration combo. Which was at least something cool to see.
Yeah, it sounds like you're getting to play off against some interesting brews. Like, I haven't heard Grease Fangs
in
a long time. The actual proper Archfiend combo, that's, you don't see that too often. And then what you describe as Black Green Sacrifice, I mean, when was the last time that was a player in the metagame? Like the Collected Company Priest of Felerites deck?
They were playing straight up Nantuko Husk. Yeah, I know.
What the heck? I didn't even know that was playing their legal. They have Catacomb Scissors.
They did. Yeah. Everything you expect.
Zulaport Cutthroats.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly all those things. I have screenshots that I will include hopefully in the show notes here. Mm-hmm. So then I decided, you know what? I'm not going to be done with this. I'm going to go back in, back to the God Eternal Kefnet content that people are here for. But I made a few changes to the deck. So I took out the Growth Spirals. I took out the Growth Spirals in favor of Opt, because Opt is a little bit of a cheaper way to trigger God Eternal Kefnet, but also it just helps smooth out your deck a little bit. And then I wanted to try some different kind of payoffs. So Teferi, Master of Time, gives you the opportunity to trigger God Eternal Kefnet for free on your opponent's turn. So I threw one of those guys in here, and someone was recommending Teferi Temporal Pilgrim as a way to potentially close games. It's the 5-drop Teferi that makes makes a spirit token that gets a +1/+1 counter every time you draw a card, which could very quickly become a lethal attacker in this deck. So I took a second version of this deck into a league, and I went, I'm going to call this 1-3, and the last match I was playing, I timed out. But this felt a lot more hopeful, and I honestly think that the first league I played with the God Eternal Kefnet Galzeth Deduce deck, it could have gone better. I do think this deck is like a 2-3-3-2 kind of middle-of-the-road thing. But in addition to the weaknesses I mentioned before, I think Divide by Zero is just getting outclassed by the format right now. Is It Charm was surprisingly great across the board, splitting the difference between being able to like counter Fable the Mirror Breakers and like kill Amalias.
Okay, so I mean, you found yourself in a very reactive role. You just happened to like Is It Charm better than Divide by Zero in the matchups you were facing. So it's interesting because your last version here, Zach, with the diversified Planeswalker suite, you've cut the green entirely. Like, you've cut the Growth Spirals, you've cut the Kellens.
Oh, no, there's Kellens. They're still there.
that cleans things up significantly. You sure? Are we talking about the same
thing? There's one where I said, if I was going to build this deck again, that I think that's what you're looking at. If you look at the top of the screenshots, I'm still playing the Kellens.
Okay, so that's my question then. Your latest version, I guess that one hasn't been tested yet. You're saying you would go so far as to just drop Kellens entirely. So we've strayed so far from the initial premise, right? Because David, I think his idea was that Kellen is more copies of Growth Spiral, so we really want a Growth Spiral. We should be doing this as often as possible. You're saying you don't like Growth Spiral, you cut that. B, you don't even like Kellen, so we're just gonna let these things happen naturally on turn four. Like you didn't find that accelerating was meaningful.
I mean, it wasn't just that it wasn't particularly meaningful. And again, I had some rough breaks with this, but like in my first league, I never once triggered God Eternal Kefnet in 5 matches. And on top of that, I had multiple times where my Growth Spirals or Kellens missed on like turn 3 or 4, where I would cast them and not be able to put an extra land into play. Now the math of the deck says that probably shouldn't have happened as much as it did, right? So I'm not necessarily going to blame the deck for that so much as I'm going to say maybe I'm just not I don't have a strong enough heart for this many things that can go this wrong, for a potential payoff that I think, even in the best case scenario, maybe isn't that great in the metagame.
No, I agree. So I tried the original list also, exact same 75 that you played in your first league, where you went 1-4. I had slightly better results. I think I went 2-2, and then I timed out my final match against Control. But I kind of felt like maybe I was favored there if I just was better at managing the clock. So somewhere between 2-3 and 3-2. But I had the same problems. I was like really struggling to make the curve happen. Like somehow, even though we built the deck to do this thing, if anything goes wrong, like if you mulligan at all, because you're a 3-color deck with pretty heavy color requirements, your odds of actually executing that turn 2 Growth Spiral into 4 mana on turn 3, they just go way down. And that even if you do that, A, you have to have the follow-up threat, which our 4-drop threats are like so-so. And then B, if you don't continue to have land drops after that, it's like you didn't accelerate at all, right? You could have just, it's not like you're closing the game early or something. So you're really only getting an advantage for that very, very tiny window. Now, it's different if you're just flush with cards and you have land drops for days, but this deck didn't really play out that way for me. There's not that much card draw here. We were leaning on Deduce to be that card draw, and it doesn't provide that volume of card flow, I found. The second issue I was having is one that you put your finger on exactly, Zach. Kefnet was not triggering that often. Like, it was very, very hard to hit on Kefnet, which is kind of sad for our Kefnet content. So I wanted to like get to the bottom of this. I took the question to our Discord, where the best God Eternal Kefnet brewers in the multiverse have assembled. Right, this is where the Kefnet minds meet, and got some helpful feedback there. So here's what the Kefnet crowd was saying. Basically, they think that Deduce is actually the trap card, and even though that was our card of the week, essentially the one that put us down this path of thinking, okay, what if we, what if we take advantage of that clue and turn it into something with Galazeth? What if we use the clue to flip Kefnet on their turn? The fact that Deduce is like a blind draw just means it's not actually helping Kefnet that much. And, Huger in our Discord was saying that he's having just a lot better success replacing Deduce with Consider and Opt. And I see you made the same change, Zach. Like, you also put Opts into your deck.
Yeah, and for the precise reason that they were talking about is like you really want to be a control deck that is maximizing your God Eternal Kefnet if you want to be a God Eternal Kefnet deck. So trying to do this other stuff with clues and treasures and Galazeth and taking turn, like Alrun's Epiphany is a great payoff card with God Eternal Kefnet, but unfortunately, I think most of the God Eternal Kefnet decks aren't able to stick multiple permanents, which is the best way to take advantage of a turn spell. And The sad thing about it, I mean, I say sad thing about it, Deduce is not a card that is particularly exciting or indicative to brewing, and we were not the people, if we ever have Damon come back, we can just play a blue-red control deck with four copies of Deduce and say, oh, it made the deck a lot better. But Deduce has already found its best homes, I think, in both Indomitable Creativity and just control decks, just playing it as two to three copies of, like, Think Twice, where it is part of your, like, card advantage engine, but it doesn't have to do anything more than that.
Well, I'm not sure I entirely agree with that, because the next deck that I want to talk about is a new take on control that works pretty well for me. But before we move off the teamer lists, yeah, so basically, if you switch to Ops, you would get more scries, right, for Kefnet. That's the idea. And I think Huger was also suggesting you could even cut Torch the Tower and put in play with Fire instead, just to have more opportunities to scry one. You know, if you flip a play with Fire off Kefnet, you can at least point it at their face, get the scry, and set up your next Kefnet draw. So if you're willing to, like, give up the ability to exile Phoenixes, like, maybe that's the way to, like, make this a proper Kefnet build. And yeah, that does require giving up on, you know, the Kellen Gross Spiral Angle. So I'll take that into consideration. I probably had much better luck with Divide by Zero than you did, Zach. Like, I thought that was one of my better cards. Like, I won most of my games where the deck was doing its thing by having Divide by Zero and by flipping Divide by Zero off Kefnet. I thought that was super powerful. And I think I liked Ill-Timeless Explosion a lot. I felt like you maybe didn't have as much success timing that correctly. What was your issue with Ill-Timed Explosion exactly?
I mean, there was a time where I had to kill a Shieldred, so I took 6 damage first, and then they played a second Shieldred and just kind of killed me. Like, yeah.
Okay. Okay.
Right, and then...
That's compelling.
I mean, for me particularly, the fact that it's a sweeper that puts me down a card... Like, when I actually want to use it as a sweeper, it puts me down a card. So, like, you have to be killing multiple creatures for it to be, like, effective as a sweeper. I mean, I guess you're filtering at the same time. I don't know. I just wasn't wowed by it, I guess. And in a lot of situations, like, I understand that we were a 3-color deck and it's double red. But I feel like Anger of the Gods is in many cases, the better card right now. And I understand that it becomes dead in control matchups, etc. But, yeah, Ill-Timed Explosion just didn't wow me. It wasn't bad, but it didn't wow me. It was nice that a lot of our creatures had like 4 or 5 toughness.
You're not down a card, right? You draw 2, discard 2, but you're down a spell, right? Like, if you're trying to kill something big, you better have, like, a good spell to chuck to it. And there's not that much that can kill a Shieldred. You have to discard exactly Elrond's Epiphany and take 4, which doesn't feel too great. Yeah, I liked it better than you did, but the line David was talking about of, like, flipping it off Kefnet and drawing 2, that didn't happen that often for me either, so...
Yeah, I mean, it literally never happened. I will say that flipping Divide by Zero off of God Eternal Kefnet, I did do that in the second league, like, 3 or 4 times. That is great. That if we could construct a deck that was making that happen more often, I would be super into that. And the core of that deck is entirely blue, right? It's like Opt considers Divide by Zero, God Eternal Kefnet. And again, I really like Teferi, Master of Time. I know he's not. I know Jace the Mind Sculptor, but he might be better. And certainly he's better at triggering Kefnet.
I mean, to be clear, I was talking about Uro when that
I remember.
Happened.
I was there. I was there in the before times.
Yes.
When the will of men failed.
All right, so enough about Teemer. We're talking about Deduce, and we promised you some 5-0s, so let's get to the 5-0s. So my issue with your comment, Zach, is that I think that Deduce actually still has a lot of potential. The next list that I played was a 4x Deduce deck, where Deduce was like a massive upgrade on previous builds of the concept. So what are we talking about? Well, if you don't want to do Galazeth stuff or Kefnet stuff, the other way to make a clue really exciting is to reduce the activation cost to almost nothing. And how do we do that? Well, you can go with Enigma Jewel. So David had proposed a couple different Enigma Jewel concepts where the addition of Deduce just gives you more confidence that your Enigma Jewel is going to have stuff to do. The main way you take advantage of Jewel is by having a lot of utility lands. Mirax is David's current favorite. Hall of Storm Giants, Otawara, Iganjo, Field of Ruin. All this stuff, you can fill up your land slot so that Enigma Jewel has stuff to do, but you really want effects that like feel more like a spell. So drawing a card off of a deduce is presumably good enough. That was a theory here. And he had a couple builds. One was blue-red, which I tried, but the blue-white one, we'll start with that, because that one was actually quite good. This build is actually going very, very heavy on this. It's not just for Enigma Jewel, it's also playing for Omen Hawkers. So we're really maxing out on the ability to get like a Soul Ring effect on turn one, then just like take advantage of that through the rest of the game. So a Shark Typhoon is probably the biggest payoff for this. You know, turn one, Enigma Jewel lets you cycle the Shark Typhoon right away and get a 2-2 drawing a card on turn two. Deduce, four copies. And then what's the rest of the deck? Well, the insight that David had was that we actually don't need to do anything else. Like, that's all we need. We have Shark Typhoons to win. We have Deduce, which is instant speed. Everything else in the deck can be reactive. So what does that mean? Counter magic, metallic rebukes, removal, get lost. Wandering Emperor is both removal and a win condition. Some one-off spells, like a smattering of 1x cards, like March of Otherworldly Light, Settle the Wreckage, Sunfall, Dovin's Vetoes. There's a Maze Mind Tome, which is somewhat similar to Reckoner Bankbuster, but actually it works better if you ever flip the Enigma Jewel. The Maze Mind Tome is better.
I have to point out that Pro Tour winning card, Secrets of the Key, making an appearance here. And yet somehow no copies of, what is it, Alquist Proft? Surprisingly to me, because I would have thought that the appeal of playing Omen Hawker was tandem of now you've got eight replicative effects, but also that Omen Hawker would be able to draw some of the fatal pushes and such that would otherwise be pointed at your Alquist. But you did not do that here, and you got the 5-0 with it.
Yeah, so I think last week's show, David had two or three Alquists in the list, but before I actually tried it, he was like, okay, Alquist is done, we're done with Alquist. Cut him and just play Flash stuff instead. So I think we just put an extra Wandering Emperor in. And I think that was the right call, because the deck worked great, it was super smooth. I got a clean 5-0. I beat up Amalia twice, I beat Boros Hammer deck. Then, after surviving against those creature decks, we switch over to the control side, where I beat Creativity with the Torrential Gearhulk Magma Opus package, and I beat the Mono Black Waste Knot on the strength of Enigma Jewel plus Utility Lands, which is an angle that they can't really stop unless they have exactly their Field of Ruins. So, on the one hand, the matches were not that interesting. Like, against the Amalia and Hammer decks, I just switched into pure control mode. Side in all my sweepers, side in my anti-creature stuff, and just outlast them. The win almost always just happened with like random Shark Typhoon tokens. Like, I didn't even cast Shark Typhoon. I just cycled the Shark Typhoon a couple times and that wins. So nothing special happening there, but I mean, it was just smooth. Like, it was just very reactive and smooth. Every time I had turn one Enigma Jewel, I just felt like I got this, you know? I know I'm going to have a big mana advantage. It was nice. Omen Hawker was not as important. I usually cut that against the creature decks just to bring in more Supreme Verdicts. On the control side against Creativity and Waste Not, like, again, I felt like I was just pretty nimble. Wandering Emperor was very, very good at just being able to flash in my win con pretty cheaply. Metallic Rebuke, being able to cast that for one. So we're trying to like squeeze extra use out of Deduce. And while it's not like a heavy improvised theme, like just the ability to have your one mana counterspell in your main deck, it came up several times. It was very good. Get Lost was very impressive. So I didn't really see any changes I wanted to make. I think I would maybe play a second Sunfall. That was much better than I expected. Just the Exile Clause was much more relevant than I thought it would be, and leaving you with a creature that you can usually flip right away because of the Enigma Jewel was very, very good. And the second change that I think someone on Discord pointed out is I should probably be playing Zerda. the main deck is only one card off Zerda. I just forgot. And David thinks Zerda is bad, so he just doesn't want to. But if you cut the Portable Hole from the main deck, you can play Zerda. And that would have been very good. So Sloth Opterist in the Discord was like, you got to play Zerda, because he's also been playing on our list to very good results as well.
Yeah, I'm always happy to see one of the companions that actually has an interesting restriction.
So I don't know, Zach. I mean, what do you think? Does this satisfy your need for Deduce Brew?
It does. I'm excited to try playing it, mostly just because I like Blue White Control, and I'm a big fan of Enigma Jewel. I haven't gotten to play it yet. I was a big fan of our good friend Omen Hawker, to the point where I actually created a promotional advertisement for him at some point. I don't forget which episode that was in, but boy did we have fun making that, I've had fun making that on your request.
I gotta make that up.
Yeah. It certainly looks like, one question I had for you is, you have no type of filtering here. Did you ever find that you were getting Enigma Jewel flooded, or is that just not an issue with the amount of card draw you have here?
Enigma Jewel flood did happen. You know, I think I'm actually supposed to like actually flip the Enigma Jewel. I never did it. I just kind of chickened out. It felt too risky. I've been told by other Enigma Jewel players in our Discord, like there's a content creator, the Big Mamu, who's been like on a huge Enigma Jewel kick. He's got a ton of great videos, a lot of them on Arena, just playing different Enigma Jewel decks on the ladder. He was like, you got to flip the jewel. Flipping the jewel is a key part of the plan. And it's not that easy to do. You need to actually have four different cards in your graveyard that have activated abilities. But if you do it, it's allegedly very powerful. So that's one way to get rid of an extra jewel. But I mean, the second jewel didn't bother me that much. Like, it's such a big advantage to have it that, yeah, I never felt like, oh, damn, there's a second jewel. It was like, okay, great, I have a jewel. I have a backup jewel just in case something happens to the first jewel. Because sometimes they killed it. I didn't feel like I was getting Enigma Jewel flooded. I felt like pretty happy to have a backup copy. And in a pinch, you can like legend rule the first jewel to flip the jewel if you need that fourth thing in the graveyard.
Okay.
So it's not, yeah, I was sick with four. I never sided them.
Great. Out. Well, it's really excited to see how much success you had with that. And I can't wait to take it out and see if we can replicate that at all. So we'll have an update hopefully by next episode of, was it a fluke or is this deck actually, solid in some way. It looks good. Looks great.
Exactly. Now, one final deduced list. Again, speaking of the Big Mamu, like they were the ones who were like working very, very hard on this Enigma Jewel Collector's Vault mana engine. If you have those two cards in play, you're activating Collector's Vault for free every turn. Free, quote unquote, which means you're getting a free loot and you're creating a treasure, like a permanent mana. So turn one jewel, turn two vault, make a treasure, means that on turn four, you've actually got seven mana already. So you're just like actually you've ramped yourself to Atraxa while filtering three times. So it's like a super powerful opening, even though it's kind of like card down twice. Like you invest two cards in Enigma Jewel and Collector's Vault and you haven't actually impacted the board in any meaningful way. But the advantage of card filtering and mana advantage should make up for that acceleration. So that's the idea. So Dave's take on this was to combine that core of Enigma Jewel and Collector's Vault into a Reenact the Crime deck. Reenact the Crime, slick little card, 4 mana instant, reanimates anything that was put into any graveyard this turn. So I just mentioned ramping to 7 for Atraxa, so you have two paths to Atraxa in this deck. You either just Collector's Vault ramp your way up to it, or you try to get it off Reenact the Crime, which can happen with Fable the Mirror Breaker. It can happen with Enigma Jewel plus Collector's Vaults. It could even happen with Enigma Jewel plus Celestis. You force the flip, and then when Celestis triggers its loot, that's how you loot the Atraxa away and reenact the crime that way. So like that's one of your combo packages, and the rest of the deck just ends up looking a little bit more like Blue-Red Control with Fables, with Shark Typhoons, four copies of Deduce here to assemble the combo and also just to like give you stuff for the Enigma Jewel to do. Torch the Tower, a couple Make Disappear, and one X Transmogrify, just for fun. The win is usually going to come from Shark Typhoon tokens and from three copies of Murex and in the mana base. That tended to be true for all of these Enigma Jewel decks. Like, you eventually win with your utility lands. So it seemed like a very clean build. I just wanted to try it and see if it felt as exciting as I thought Reenact the Crime might feel. And the answer was, like, kind of yes. Like, my first couple of matches, I did the thing a couple times, and I was, like, so slick. Like, the Vampires deck, they get their Sorin, they get their Vein Ripper, and it's like, okay, you have a 6/5 flyer. Would you like to attack me into my 4 open mana? Because I've got Reenact the Crime. I may have Atraxa coming back. And, yeah, Atraxa just straight up colds everything that the Sorin-Vein Ripper combo is trying to do. So that seems to be the trump for the Vampires metagame. So I got a clean 2-0 against Vampires, got a clean 2-0 against Waste Not, where I was able to just, you know, use their own Liliana against them with Reenact the Crime. Like, I didn't have a discard outlet, but I knew they were going to Liliana me, so I just, like, sat on that and embarrassed them that way. Two matches against Lotus Fields, where I was able to win one of those matches by having the Enigma Jewel Collector's Vault engine just letting me assemble Atraxa fast enough to actually kill them. I lost the other match. I felt like, you know, maybe I should have won that, but they snuck through. They snuck out an early Leer in the final game, and I didn't have an answer for Leer. So split those matches and then ended up losing to Phoenix. You know, despite having Torch the Tower as my go-to kill spell, I just couldn't get rid of those Phoenixes. It was too tough. Reenact the Crime is actually not very good at getting rid of Phoenix. Like, I thought maybe I would use it to exile their Phoenixes, but it's very hard to do. Like, because it can only target a Phoenix that went through this turn, which is very tricky. Because they can discard that whenever they want.
And at 4 mana, that's pretty prohibitive, right?
Exactly. So 3-2 overall, but the deck felt powerful. That being said, the Reenact the Crime angle did not feel that powerful. Like, it felt almost like that was an outlier in the deck. And if you just cut that, you would have a much more powerful deck.
So, hold on. Are you suggesting that you would also cut the Atraxas? Or would you keep the Atraxas with the only way to get them to play, making a bunch of treasures and casting?
Kind of. I felt like the game went long enough that I could have cast Atraxa. Now, unfortunately, David's mana base was, like, pretty responsible. It was blue-red focused. He didn't put in off-color lands. So I would have to, like, cobble it together with treasures and, like, Sunken Citadels on black or white. I think if you just, like, put more Triumphs...
Don't forget the Mirex. Don't forget the Mirex. That first turn it comes into play, it could spot you. Public service announcement.
So I did forget the Mirex. I totally forgot about that.
Yeah, right? That's a wild line. Yeah.
Totally forgot about
that. I know.
But even so, I had to run the numbers, but I think you just want a couple more Atraxa colored lands. If you did that, I would feel like pretty confident. But the other thing is you could just cut that entirely. You could just play the Shark Typhoon endgame. Like, the blue-white list that I trophied with, you're just winning with Shark Typhoon. This list can actually cast Shark Typhoon. Like, I cast Shark Typhoon a bunch of times in this list because of the treasures. And, you know, it didn't feel like the Atraxa thing was actually helping that much in the matches where I didn't exactly pull off the combo, which happened like 2 or 3 times in the league. So is that trade-off worth it? Or would it be better off just playing generic control top end?
Yeah, I was about to ask you, like, is it worth playing specifically Atraxa, or could you play something like, I don't know, Hullbreaker Horror, or I don't know what the mono blue payoff du jour or blue red payoff du jour should be, but whatever that is, if that's possible as a substitute.
Yeah. So takeaways are that Enigma Jewel Collector's Vault was very good. I love Deduce in this deck. I was a little bit suspicious of it during our last week's episode. I thought it was just like hanging out doing nothing, but it was, you know, it was on plan, and I love the Jewel, and the Jewel needs things to feed it, and Deduce was good enough for that purpose. So I think there's something here. Like, honestly, I felt like I was going to 5-0 with this, even though, you know, 3-2 just feels average. Like, this was a powerful 3-2. Like, I felt like Lotus Combo kind of stole the last match from me. And then in the Phoenix mirror, it's not a mirror, sorry, in the Phoenix matchup, the blue-red mirror, you know, you never go into that feeling that you're going to lose. You feel like you have a chance. Maybe I wasn't built correctly. I just wasn't experienced enough how to actually stop them. But there's got to be a solution to that. Like, the deck felt like it was doing something very powerful.
Yeah, it certainly looks like it. And I would say that Dave is as insightful as ever with his assessment of the format. You'll notice that the mid-range, fair, kind of clunky deck that we were trying to play felt the worst and did the worst. And decks that are either trying to do something very unfair or trying to do something incredibly conservative did quite well. The blue-white control-ish Enigma Jewel shell and this more combo-focused shell. So just to say that right now the format is not very conducive to just playing kind of fair creature and removal mid-range. Which is not necessarily a bad thing, just a thing to know.
Exactly. Like, I was leaning heavily on counterspells to survive this. Like, if I didn't have counter magic, there was no way to not get comboed out against a wide variety of decks. Okay, so, Zach, do you want to talk about this blue-white list?
Yeah, white-blue cryptic coat humans. This was a wonderful list from David. This was one of the batch of the first lists that he put together when MKM came out. So what we're doing here is playing kind of like a blue-white tempo humans kind of shell, with the joke being, of course, that deck doesn't exist right now. So instead of playing any of the normal stuff, we're playing Novice Inspector and Thraven Inspector alongside Portable Hole. We've got Charming Princes, Thalia's Lieutenant, three copies of Denik, Pious Apprentice, Malevolent Hermit, and then the kind of the key to this deck is the four copies of Cryptic Coat, teaming up with four copies of Teleportation Circle. So this is kind of a value engine in a couple of different ways. Cryptic Coat, obviously, on its own is a potentially very grindy card that generates value pulling cards off the top of your library. And then Teleportation Circle lets you flicker a lot of your ETB effects or enters effects or comes into play effects, CIP, which I feel like I'm going to move back to. You can generate clues with the Teleportation Circle by blinking Thraven Inspectors. You can generate a lot of power and toughness with Thalia's Lieutenant. You can scry and gain life with our good friend Charming Prince. And even flickering Cryptic Coat gives you extra manifests off the top of your deck, where you disguise the top card of your deck. And then the last card that I didn't mention is actually one of the most important, which is Reflector Mage. So Reflector Mage just generally is great in creature matchups, or even some of the mid-range matchups where they'll throw down something chonky like a Shieldred to try to stop you from finishing them off, and then Reflector Mage just swings it back to their hand, and then you're able to close that out. So this is actually interesting. I played this a while back. It was like maybe 3 weeks ago. And this was pre-Vampires deck, so I remember one of my matches was against Black-Red Midrange, just straight-up Black-Red Midrange, and one of the hilarious interactions was that Denik, Pious Apprentice, stopped their Graveyard Trespasser from being able to trigger, both on entering play or attacking. It wasn't able to gain them any life or exile any cards, so that was kind of cool. Denik and Malevolent Hermit give this deck some kind of graveyard grindiness where you have creatures that are able to come back in a flipped mode. So I can't see my results right now. Hopefully you can, Dan, because I think I posted them. I want to say it was something along the lines of 2-3 that could have gone better. And I remember I split matches against Phoenix. I beat Lotus Field at least once, and then I played the Black-Red Midrange deck, and I cannot remember the fourth matchup. Deck felt pretty interesting, pretty smooth. It was fun to play. With one of the major downsides being that, one, Teleportation Circle is very reliant on you having like other stuff to do with it. And if you don't have the right thing for the matchup, it can be a little frustrating in that way. In that also Teleportation Circle just doesn't really do anything itself. And then the funny thing was Cryptic Coat in this deck really didn't work as well as I thought it was going to as a grinding kind of value engine, because so many of your creatures have come into play. Triggers, a lot of the time you'll be pulling those off the top of your deck, and it's like, oh, cool, I Cryptic Coat, and I got a Reflector Mage, and now I guess I can spend 3 mana to make it a 3-3 instead of a 3-2. And then it loses ward. So, just some slightly kind of unintuitive moments like that. Overall, the kind of shell of this deck was pretty good. It could beat down surprisingly quickly, and you had the right mixture of disruption to be able to beat a deck like Lotus Field. So that felt good. Yeah, basically one of the biggest problems with this deck was, again, twofold. Teleportation Circle requires other cards in order to be able to do something, and sometimes you don't have the right piece to interact with your Teleportation Circle for the specific matchup. And then on the flip side, Cryptic Coat is a great kind of grindy card, but it doesn't help you actually like close the game when you need to end faster. And then on top of that, a lot of your best creatures have Enter the Battlefield triggers, CIP, as I'm going to call them from here on out. And
Interest triggers. Ease triggers.
No. It comes into play.
I don't understand you at all. You've lost me completely. What is this ancient boomer lingo?
Yeah, that's right. Cryptic Coat, denies you the enter abilities on some of your best creatures. So it's kind of a double-edged sword. So I think this deck would do better if you were just to focus on either Cryptic Coat or Teleportation Circle as the kind of top-end grindiness and add either more disruption or beat down in the main deck and then be able to sideboard in one or the other direction.
I have questions about Cryptic Coat. So I've noticed that this is one of the more successful cards from the set. Sometimes you'll find it like 1 or 2x in a Phoenix list or something. Sometimes main, sometimes side. People just seem to be getting decent results just playing it as a grindy source of like, I don't know, this card advantage. It's just like endgame finisher. I'm just like not totally convinced. Like I played one in that blue-white list that I 5-0'd with. It was okay. It wasn't anything special. So am I just like not understanding the power of the coat? Like what was your assessment of the power level of the coat?
I mean, I think that it is really that, like what you just said there, like it's not that good, but it is like a constant source of card flow. And I think for Phoenix and sometimes for this deck, it just breaks a board stall. Like I've seen Phoenix opponents, I've beaten Phoenix opponents where sometimes you can just kind of get a lock on the game. And you're at like 3 and they can just not get anything through to kill you and you just win. And it's like if they could just resolve one creature that didn't have to worry about getting blocked, they would be able to take it, but they can't.
Interesting. Okay.
One of the biggest downsides in this deck too was the fact that it has no equip cost. So like it's like as long as they can pull out a piece of removal each turn, you just keep resetting the coat. But unfortunately, Phoenix can do that. Like Phoenix can churn through his deck at a point where it's just like, yeah, I can do 2 damage a turn for 5 turns in a row and stop you from ever killing me, even though I'm at 3.
So paying 5 mana a turn doesn't appeal to you. And you found that like the teleportation Cryptic Coat combo was like not worth it.
Yeah, well, I mean, no, paying 5 mana a turn is totally fine to me. It's just like, Cryptic Coat and Teleportation Circle were kind of trying to do the same thing, and they didn't really play that well together.
I see. Okay.
I'm just saying it's like this deck had a little bit too much of these like 3 and 4 mana cards that didn't impact the board and kind of like were trying to do this like grindy endgame that most of the time you didn't need.
Yeah, it seemed like you were getting most of your wins from Malevolent Hermit protecting you from a combo while your random dude was chipped away.
Well, and just the shocking speed of beatdown in this deck was pretty surprising to me. That, like, I don't know, Thraven Inspector, Charming Prince, Thalia's Lieutenant was like, it put a lot of power onto the battlefield that a lot of people were just like not really well equipped to play against. And I think I even could have won the second match against Phoenix. I'm not looking at my notes on it right now, but I believe part of the, like, one of the things that happened is, like, I got hit with a sweeper. I think it was Anger of the Gods. And, like, if my sequence or if my draw had been slightly different, like, I would have had a creature or two to survive and just kill them. But they just completely nailed me where they wiped my board with that, where otherwise it probably wouldn't do.
Maybe just, like, trying to kill them faster? Board into the Inner Sky, full set of inspectors.
Yeah, that would be good. Maybe get the rest of the inspectors in here. We're only playing 6 and we could be playing 8. Yeah, Warden of the Inner Sky sounds like an okay choice. Just anything that like adds a little bit more power or a little bit more disruption would probably be great.
Okay.
Even like Spell Pierce, honestly. Like something like that would just like tip it.
You play Spell Pierce instead of more Hermits.
You might just play more Hermits. I don't know. I'm just saying like something in that direction. I'd have to look at what more of the options are.
Gotcha. Okay. Good feedback. Searching for that successful list, we did promise you multiple trophies. So let's, at least before we close out, let's get to that second 5-0 list.
Yeah, this is very, very exciting. I mean, I'm excited to play multiple decks that we're talking about today, and I do not have enough time right now, and I I don't want to wait 3 more weeks, but I will be home. I will be home in 3 weeks and able to stream. So very excited about that. It's coming up soon. So ostensibly this week's card of discussion is Prof's eidetic memory, right? And you folks were talking about that with a couple of different potential interactions. I know Rona was one of them, of illustrious combo fame, potentially Ledger Shredder. And I'm incredibly happy to see Steam Core Weird. I have to be totally clear with you. I listened to your episodes where you were talking through the cards from the set at least 2 or 3 times each while I was in the gym. And somehow...
Why would you do that to yourself?
Because I like listening to you guys, and I like listening about the cards. But a lot of the cards I never actually physically looked at. Steam Core Weird being 3 mana. Yeah, okay, I totally got that. Being a 2-2 flyer. Yeah, totally got that. Vigilance, totally got that. Did not realize it's mono blue. I thought it was blue and red. Because it's a weird... Like, a lot of the weirds are blue-red. This is, like... This card is bonkers.
Well, I think it's possible that you're thinking of the actual card Steam Core Weird has a red kicker. This is Steam Core Scholar.
Creature type is a weird.
Steam Core Scholar...
I honestly can't look at the card right now. My Notion has decided to be in an infinite loading zone.
Steam Core Scholar, if you've ever seen the show The Expanse, the detective who's also a ghost, that's what this creature is, right? Forgot that character's name. But yeah, mono blue, super, super Windrake. David was pretty high on this. I was not as convinced during the preview season.
No, you in fact made fun of it by calling it Windrake.
Yeah, well, I was a little bit upset at the history of Windrakes. Now, David is going so far in his notes here to say that the Prof's Eidetic Memory is the third best card from this set, for Pioneer at least. If you're following closely the metagame trends, you may see the Prof's Eidetic Memory pop up occasionally in like Phoenix. I don't think it's like a staple card by any stretch. But tell us what the card does, Zach.
So it's 1 and a blue legendary enchantment. When it enters the battlefield, you draw a card. Sorry, I'm doing this from memory. Let me see if I can pull it up.
Doing it from your eidetic memory, hopefully.
Yeah, I wish.
Okay, so ETB, draw a card. Or sorry, E, draw a card. When it E's, you draw a card. No maximum hand size.
Yeah.
And then it says, at the beginning of combat on your turn, if you draw more than one card this turn, you get to put X +1/+1 counters on target creature you control, where X is the number of cards you've drawn this turn, -1. So basically any extra cards beyond the first turn into Luminarch Aspirant triggers, and you get as many counters as you drew cards. So the turn you play the Prof's Memory, it cantrips, and now you've successfully drawn an extra card. So if you have a creature, you can distribute a counter on it. Later in the game, though, it gets to really pop off, right? So if you're drawing like 2, 3, or 4 cards in a turn, when you go to combat, you're putting like 2, 3, or 4 counters on a creature, which can be kind of nutty.
Yeah, it sounds like it would be, right?
It sounds like it. I mean, so David's comparing it here to not just Luminarch Aspirant, where it's kind of like what if Luminarch Aspirant were an Elvish Visionary? But he's saying compare this to Fable of the Mirror Breaker, right?
Wow. That's lofty.
Fable creates 4 power and filters 2 draws. He says the Prof will actually, instead of filtering 2 draws, it replaces itself, which is maybe better. And then it adds 1 to 5 power every single turn for the rest of the game, if you've built your deck to do that. So it's somehow like more powerful than Fable. It's also like an Elvish Visionary with haste, or a supercharged Luminarch Aspirant that has replaced itself and can't be killed. This is like the ceiling for Prof.
Well, the one thing I always said about Elvish Visionary is that the only thing holding it back is that it doesn't have haste.
Thank you for saying that, Zach. Yes. We need a haste Elvish Visionary. Where is Modern Horizons 3 going to deliver the haste Elvish Visionary?
I honestly just don't know what they're waiting on. I don't.
And they're printing Priest of Titania instead. Come on. That's not what Elvish needs.
Nerds.
Okay, so... If you believe David, if you believe his diatribe about how Prof's Eidetic Memory is so great, it's interesting because he's been telling me for weeks that, like, oh, we're not going to do a week on this. It's not worth a week. And yet he just like rattles off a 5-0 and you know, he's got like three sweet lists here. So let's just talk about like what this card can do. So you mentioned Steam Core Scholar. So what happens if I play Profit on turn two and I play Steam Core Scholar on turn three?
Okay. Yeah. I mean, you're going to draw a card from playing it. Unfortunate. Like, that's not great, right? One and a blue enchantment, draw a card. Not great, right? Then you play your Steam Core Scholar on the next turn. You're going to draw two, discard one, hopefully, unless you really want to hold on to all your instants and sorceries. And your Steam Core Scholar is going to become a 4/4 Flying Vigilance. Is that correct?
Oh, yes. 4/4 Flying Vigilance.
I mean, if your opponent has creatures, that's a great size, right? Like, that's pretty good. And I will say, like, this deck also has four copies of Rona. It also has four copies of Evangel of Synthesis, which, for those who don't remember, when it enters the battlefield, has a draw discard. It also has four copies of Ledger Shredder. All creatures who are able to come in and, I mean, Rona, obviously not immediately Rona. You want to sequence the Rona, then Prophesy Eidetic Memory. But, I mean, adding extra toughness, adding extra girth to these bodies is really important. I mean, they almost every single one of them immediately goes up to four toughness, right?
At least four. So in David's notes, you know, he says that, well, we were initially thinking that Steam Core Scholar would be like a great curve, but the much better curve, the one that actually pushed this deck over the top and let him get the 5-0, was understanding that Ledger Shredder into Proft is almost unbeatable, right? So what happens if you play Ledger Shredder, follow that up with a Proft plus a one drop on turn three? Turn two, you have a Ledger Shredder pass. That's not great, but let's just assume it survives. Now it's turn three. Play your third land, play your Proft, draw a card. Play your second spell, let's say it's a Fatal Push, or a Consider, or an Opt, or a Thoughtseize.
Well, if it's an Opt or a Consider, it's a different ballgame, because that's actually drawing you a card. Then you're conniving, which is drawing you a card. So now your Ledger Shredder is picking up three counters, assuming you discarded a non-land card.
It's a Ledger Shredder triggers itself, becoming a 2/4. Now you've drawn two or three extra cards that turn. So you've at least gone to 4/6 on your Shredder.
Right.
If it was a Consider, you potentially went to 5/7 on turn three.
Woo. That's a big boy.
That creature is almost impossible for blue-red to kill. Like, once you get to 6 toughness, you're safe from most of what blue-red is trying to do. So that seems to be like the strength of the deck. Okay, it's just a Ledger Shredder deck, but I mean, it's a supercharged Ledger Shredder deck. Like, it's a brew until people decide that Prophet's Eidetic Memory is actually just a good card, and then it'll just be like an obnoxious build. I think the parts that maybe are not totally convincing yet are the Rona and Evangel of Synthesis lines. Probably Evangel's better than Rona. I think David didn't quite say which one he liked better, but people in our Discord have been testing the list over the past couple days, and the feedback on Rota is like a little bit mixed. It's kind of doing its own thing. Like, you're not really going to flip it. It's just sort of their looting. Like, it's not looting for much profit. It's the looting is only just fueling treasure crews and getting you additional profit triggers. But beyond that, it's not like you're building to a combo or anything like that.
Yeah, now that we know what committing a crime is, how do we feel about potentially playing Nathan Stoyer?
Ooh, that's an idea.
Yeah. When Thunder Junction comes out, I mean, we're going to have to do that, because whichever one of those is the most easily or most happily replaced, maybe he would be a good fit. We are definitely molesting our opponent with this blue-black deck.
So, speaking of Nathan Stoyer, David has added it to his notes here, a new turn four combo kill in Standard, which...
Oh my!
If you hear this, you're like... Is it actually a combo kill if it's a turn four kill? But it involves Duelist of the Mind and Prof's Memory. The context here, and I'm kind of glossing over this because it's kind of hard to visualize, but if you have access to our extended show notes, if you look at David's screenshots from his 5-0 league in Pioneer with this Prof's Memory deck, he'll have like one creature, like a Ledger Shredder, just like attacking for 15 damage on turn four or five, right? Like, it just grows that big. You just get that many triggers. So he's thinking, what if I can do the same thing with Duelist of the Mind? Now, he came up with a very convoluted sequence. It involves the card Coveted Falcon. So it's the Maltese Falcon, right? It's 3 mana right. For a 1/4 flying bird. Whenever it attacks, you gain control of target permanent you own but don't control.
Oh, okay. So it is that card. Okay.
It looks terrible to me. Now, that's not right. The cool part. The cool part is the disguise part. You disguise the Falcon, you flip it up for 2 mana, so that's a 5 mana total investment.
You donate permanents to your opponent.
You donate any number of permanents you control to your opponent, and you draw a card for each one that they gain control of this way. It's so stupid. Like,
okay.
I urged him to not even include this in the spoiler assets because it's such a bad card. You give away all your... It's such a terrible idea.
You know what, though? If he puts his brewing where his mouth is, if he actually builds and plays the decks containing this, as he alluded he may, then you know what? That's fine. You know? It's totally fine.
So the entire point is to give away all your stuff and draw cards. And he's like, well, if I have Duelist the Mind and Prof's Memory was going to reward me for drawing cards. Duelist of the Mind is going to reward me for committing crimes, right? And the Coveted Falcon targets their stuff. So you're committing crimes that way. So here's the curve, right? Turn one, Case of the Filched Falcon. It's Falcon Tribal, Falcon Mystery Tribal. And the only purpose of Case of the Filched Falcon is to provide permanence. So you get your Saga and you get your Clue, right? Turn
two. So you're up to three.
Yeah, Duelist of the Mind. Pass. Turn three, you disguise your face down creature. They have no idea what it is.
Six. Okay. Right. Okay.
Now turn four, play your land, play your Cross
seven,
Memory.
Okay.
So
eight.
Now we've invested 2 mana. We've cantripped. We go to combat. The Cross Memory trigger is on the stack, so it's about to distribute a single counter onto your Duelist of the Mind. But
what if?
Exactly. What if? What if in response to the trigger, we flip the Coveted Falcon, right? Now we've tapped out. We donate all of our stuff. We donate everything. We donate the 4 lands. We donate our 1-drop, Case of the Filched Falcon, and the Clue, because we don't need those. And you donate the Prof's Memory, because you don't need that anymore, right? It can just be on their side. The trigger is still going to resolve. The donate will trigger the crime for the duelist, so you loot, right? And now you've got how many card draws have you... You've drawn for the turn, you've drawn for the Prof's Memory entering the battlefield, you've drawn for the duelists, you've donated seven permanents and drawn 7 more.
Yeah.
So that's 10 power. Duelist is now a 10 power attacker just by itself.
Right.
Then the memory trigger resolves, so adds 9 more counters. So now you have a 19 power Duelist of the Mind. And of course, the 1/4 Maltese Falcon delivering the final peck, the killing blow. I think this is so stupid, Zach.
It's incredibly stupid.
I'm just amazed that David not only typed this all out, but he's like, all right, this is the sauce, right? Like, forget the 5-0. We don't need that meta-breaking 5-0 deck. What we really need is a turn 4 standard kill. How many cards does it take? You need 4 lands.
You know what? Don't question the man's methods, because this is the same brain that brought us 2 5-0s in the last week, right? So you know what? If this is part of what it takes, then you know what? I'm all for it. Let's falcon it up.
God, falcon. I just I don't know. Like, what?
You like Case of the Filched Falcon. What are you complaining about?
Yeah, but he's not even using it. Like, why not just play Siren, Spyglass Siren instead?
Sure, why not?
That one at least
now you've got
pick up counters from the Prof's Memory.
But now you've got 8 replicative effects. Now you got a rule of 8.
Oh, okay. I forgot about the replicative effects. My bad.
You have to have consistency, Daniel. You have to focus on consistency. It's not just about doing the thing once.
Yeah. I've said all I can say about that combo line.
Yeah. But you said more than maybe needs to be said in most cases.
Apologize, everyone, but you all knew what you were signing up for when you, you subscribed to this podcast. Let's close it out, Zach, with some actual lists. So David has given us 2 more actual lists in Pioneer. If you don't like the demure version of Prof's Memory, we've actually got 3 more lists. So let's take a look at these.
Would that I could. Okay, I can see them. Great. Super. We've got a really... No, that's... Hold on. That's an entirely different card. That's, what is that? Hide in plain sight. We're not talking about hide in plain sight.
Scroll down past those. Keep scrolling.
Oh, I'm scrolling. I'm scrolling, baby. All right. So other ideas for prof. So we've got another blue-black deck here. But this is Blood for Bones with Atraxa. Ooh, ah. So taking advantage of Steam Core Scholar's ability to discard, I assume, as well as Evangel of Synthesis and Rona and Prof's Eidetic Memory, all of these teaming together to give us a lot of card flow here. So that we can discard Atraxa and then sacrifice one of our creatures to get it back with Blood for Bones. Does that seem like the general plan here?
It seems to be. If he liked the idea of having discard outlets in his 5-0 list, yeah, why not try to reanimate something? Surprisingly, he cut the Ledger Shredders from this one and kept the Ronas, kept the Evangels, kept the Steam Core Scholars. I would have like cut the Ronas myself and kept the Shredder, like Shredder if that was the most important power up, but maybe the idea is that he's cut the cantrip suite, so there's not as many ways to trigger Shredder.
Yeah, that does seem to be the case, right? And Rona just gives you a consistent ability to loot. There's also multiple legendary permanents in this deck, right? There's Kaito Shizuki, that's going to give you an extra, and then Profs is legendary, so not that it's a big part of it, but it's there.
And there's one little note here about the card Ingenious Prodigy. X and a blue for a 0/1 human wizard with skulk, and it gets X +1/+1 counters when you cast it. Then on your upkeep, you have the ability to like trade a counter for a card to draw an extra card. You actually don't have to connect with this. So the idea here is that if you lead on a turn one Prodigy as a 0/1 skulk, turn two Prof's Memory, you can just draw a card off that for the rest of the game. For as long as the Prodigy survives, you dump the memory counter onto the Prodigy, upkeep, take it off, draw a card, triggers the memory again, puts the counter back on, etc., etc. So that's kind of cute. Like, now David doesn't believe in it enough to play multiple copies of Prodigy, but I do wonder if there's something worth exploring there.
Yeah, I would have to give it a shot myself. I was looking at that card in here and being like, what does this do? I can't read all the text right now. I'm just going to ignore it. But it's good to know that there is some deranged reasoning behind it, and perhaps not so deranged.
So in terms of like changes between this list and the previous one, it's basically taking out the cantrips and putting in this unfair combo. Beyond that, like the core creatures and prof core is the same. Falsies, push, 12 creatures, 2 Kaitos. Yeah, so not much more to say about that.
I will say that it's definitely going to suffer on consistency for power here. So if that's a trade you're willing to make, and if that's what the metagame feels like it demands, then go for it. Next up, we have what is titled as Blue-White Beats, and this is a Tezzeret Betrayer of Flesh deck, and I am oh so excited about this. I love that card. So in this, we've got the full suite of inspectors for Novice and for Thraben Inspector, along with Warden of the Inner Sky and Spyglass Siren. So this is almost like a Boros Convoke-looking configuration, along with one Skrelv Defector Knight. We've got some portable holes and a Mox Amber. Rona appears again because it's a great combination card with Prof's Eidetic Memory, as well as Steam Core Scholar. And then it's filled out with a little bit of interaction in the form of Metallic Rebuke and Get Lost. Because Tezzeret still has the ability to make something into a 4/4 and make an artifact into a 4/4 beater, right? I'm assuming just the general idea here is to be kind of a disruptive beatdown deck with Prof's Eidetic Memory kind of serving as a the white creature that you referenced earlier.
Yeah, it's a Luminarch Aspirant. You're not going to get as many triggers here, right? You have to like actually spend mana to crack clues, which doesn't sound too good. But on the flip side, there's so many one drops, right? There's 17 one drops, so it's very, very likely that if you have Profed on turn two, you're going to actually benefit from that initial trigger. And then if you happen to draw your Steam Core Scholar, or you can just invest in cracking clues, all you have to do that in your main phase, which is not so good. You could potentially power up. I think the card David is most excited about is Warden of the Inner Sky. That one gains flying when it has 3 counters, but it doesn't actually specify where the counters came from. So you can get the counters from Profed or from its own ability of like tapping clues and maps. So that's pretty cool. And then Tezzeret's, I mean, we've been betrayed so many times by Tezzeret. And yet, like all the abilities seem good, right? The static ability lets you crack the clues for free. The draw 2, discard 1. is great with Proft, great, quote unquote. You need threats, right. So turning things into 4/4 attackers seems good. Like, in theory, Tezzeret does everything. We know from long experience that Tezzeret sucks, but
yeah,
this is like the triumph of hope over experience. Let's just try it again. Let's put Tezzeret back in. I feel like we'd be better off just putting in more Metallic Rebukes, most likely.
Yeah, and I also wonder about Filch Falcon in here. I don't know if there's actually enough artifacts to, like, quote-unquote flip it a lot of the time, but at the same time, it does give you another way to, like, create, like, a flying beater. And the flying 4/4 obviously is a deal. If there was, yeah, there's a single Darksteel Citadel in here, but maybe, yeah. Just something to think about, I guess.
Would you play that instead of one of the one drops?
I'm not sure. I really am not. I have really no idea. Maybe cut a Rona, because, well, I guess 4 seems like a lot, but it can loot itself away. So I don't know. I'm not sure. But it does seem like something that would be maybe pretty good in here.
Yeah, Rona feels like an outlier, doesn't it?
A little bit. Yeah. But I mean, it's fine at what it's doing.
I could see that being Omen Hawkers, maybe. I could see mm-hmm. that being, I don't know, even Thalia's Lieutenant, if you just need more power on the board.
Yeah.
Okay, so that is a blue-white list seeking to take advantage of Proft Eidetic Memory as an aggressive beatdown Luminarch Aspirant-style card. So heavy on the one-drops. One final list. This one's getting a little bit more speculative. Proft's Eidetic Memory is, among other things, it's an enchantment. So you could potentially play this with the Enchantress-style suite. Now, in Pioneer, that means Eidolon of Blossoms, that means Setessan Champion. When you hear Eidolon of Blossoms, you're not thinking, I should build a beatdown deck, so maybe that's the wrong direction. However, Setessan Champion does get kind of large. And there are other cards that we've seen, like the Bogle-style decks play, Generous Visitor being the main one. It's a one drop. Okay, that's promising. That whenever enchantments come in, it's distributing counters. So maybe it's kind of doing the same thing as Proft. And on top of that, we have a new addition, Elvish Archivist. Elvish Archivist is a two drop that will draw cards off enchantments, or it will grow off of artifacts. So David's insight here is that what if Proft's memory allows us to functionally not to worry about the artifact half of the Elvish Archivist? Right, all we need to do is just like draw cards, because Proft is paying us off for that, and drawing cards is inherently good. So we'll use Proft to make the Archivist huge, and then we'll essentially be playing these 12 Enchantress-style creatures, Generous Visitor, Elvish Archivist, Setessan Champion, 4 Proft's Memory, 3 Jolryle Moanvuli Recluse. Now, what's that doing here? Well, Jolryle, whenever you draw your second card a turn, spits out a cat. We've had a whole week to this years ago, back when Aspiring Spike was still a young lad who would come on our podcast and brew Jolryle decks with us. David's line that he loved was turn one, Unbridled Growth. Followed it up with a Jolryle, you can sack the Unbridled Growth at any time for drawing a card. So it really, it's kind of like the Pioneer Mishra's Bauble, lets you trigger that second cat. So between Unbridled Growth, Jolryle, and the Enchantress Core, you can see that we're doing something here with enchantments that add power, enchantments that draw cards, and then just to round it all out, he's sliding in Smuggler's Copter, which grows the Elvish Archivist, which creates that second card draw. Doesn't quite work timing-wise with Proft the way we would want, but that's okay. Like, it's still like a hard-to-kill flyer. You can dump counters onto it. To finish out the list, you need to interact, and unfortunately we're in the colors mono green with a light blue splash. These are by far the worst colors for interacting, so this is, I think, just a weakness of the deck that maybe David acknowledges that we don't know how to solve it yet. So he's not really trying to solve it. He's proposing an interactive suite of Royal Treatment, Witness Protection, and Spell Pierce. 2 copies of each, and basically we're not really sure which ones are going to be important, but all of those like have seen play in different contexts. I think Royal Treatment is the most exciting one, creating that I forget the role, but the role is an enchantment, so that will trigger all of your enchantresses while protecting your enchantress from removal. I love everything that's like here in front of us. I have no idea if this is like actually functional. Like, I don't know how long it takes to actually kill them. I don't know if this deck can successfully interact long enough to fend off the opponent's combo. As David was saying at the top, right, this is a combo heavy Pioneer format. But it looks so sweet and so different from what we're seeing other decks trying to do that I think we got to just try this. It looks too delicious to pass up. We'll just have to build a really good sideboard. Somehow shore up all the weaknesses against the actual metagame. But all right, so we've been going on some length. That's Prof's Eidetic Memory, a card that David vowed was not worth a week, and yet he's already 5-0'd, and yet he's got these three additional sweet concepts with it. Lots to explore here. I think we got to leave it here. Zach, I know you got to head out. You got another work shift, so I will let you bid us farewell, and you know, then we're going to take these into the queues and test them out. We'll let you know next time how it turned out.
So I have to get going to work. I'm still here working on the cruise ship. So I got to jet off and help welcome guests. We are taking on 4,000 to 5,000 brand new human beings, and they'll have a lot of questions. So sometimes I have to do a job where I'm mostly answering those questions. And of course, I'm always happy to answer questions about Magic, about cruise ship life, whatever it is. You can find me on the Faceless Brewing Discord as Mana Symbol, I'm pretty sure, as well as Twitter, YouTube, and Twitch, although obviously I haven't been streaming for a while, but I will be back to that in about 3 weeks.
Yes.
So, Dan, thank you so much for having me. This is one of my favorite things to do. I love Magic, love the Faithless Brewing crew, and I've been kind of on-roading myself back to participating in this, and I hope to be doing so more frequently in the near future.
I'm super excited, Zach. Can't wait for you to get back, get your land legs back.
Yeah.
Potential future Magic Online content creator. We don't know. We'll see.
Yeah, could be. And
all that.
That's right. And I'm always on the look for the next disappointing Tarmogoyf that draws a card. I was very happy to see that blue-white Urza in a few different forms has occasionally been successful again in Modern. And sometimes playing one whole copy of Ingenious Smith. And that's all it takes, baby. That's all it takes.
All right. I'm looking forward to all that. Zach, great to see you. And we will see you all next time.